The next speaker is Bill Hartung from the Centre for International Policy. He's the author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, Nation Books 2011, and co-editor with Miriam Pemberton of Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, Paradigm Press 2008. His previous books include Weapons for All, Harper & Collins, a critique of US arms sales policies from the Nixon through Clinton administrations. From July 2007 through March 2011, he was the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New American Foundation. Prior to that, he served as a director of the Arms Trade Resource Center at the World Policy Institute. He also worked as a speechwriter and policy analyst for the New York State Attorney General Robert Abrams. Bill Hartung's articles on security issues have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times, The Nation, and World Policy Journal. He's also a featured expert on national security issues. His title is Inordinate Power and Pathological Dynamics of the U.S. Military-Industrial Complex. Bill.
I want to thank Helen for that introduction. I don't know why the least important speaker gets the longest introduction, but I'll take it. So Bruce covered a lot of ground, and my presentation is going to be a bit narrower. It's really about the politics of the military-industrial complex, and he gave some good examples of that. But the term military-industrial complex itself, as you know, came from President Eisenhower's farewell address. And so the first question is, why did he choose to make his last words to the nation about this issue? And I think ultimately, you know, the part of the speech that people are most familiar with has to do with unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex. But I think perhaps more important is the ending of the speech, where he talks about it as a threat to democracy. And he said, "We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together." I'm not sure how big a machine we need to mesh with, but nonetheless, the spirit of it was that life and death decisions were being made in an undemocratic way. And I think that's really what drove the speech. Now, nuclear weapons were not only present at the creation of the military-industrial complex, but they were an integral part of how it came to be and how it came to be sustained. Of course, the Manhattan Project, which was one of the largest industrial undertakings in human history, created the base for a lot of what we see now as the nuclear warhead complex. But even so, in any case, not only do we have the Manhattan Project setting the sort of infrastructure of the nuclear arms race, but Eisenhower tangled with the nuclear lobby continuously, and that was really what led him to get the concept of the military-industrial complex. The Air Force and the industry wanted to build a new bomber, a new nuclear bomber, the B-70. Eisenhower didn't think it was necessary, but he had to fight tooth and nail against it, even to the point where his own generals were giving testimony against him. You know, the theory is supposed to be there's a commander-in-chief, they make a decision, and the military folks walk in line. But in this case, they were talking out of school and challenging their own president to build a bomber that we did not need. So that was his first indication that this complex was getting out of hand. But more importantly, and perhaps more unfortunately, he was blindsided by the missile gap controversy late in his term. There was faulty intelligence circulated by industry, by folks in the Air Force and elsewhere, that we were far behind the Soviet Union in the production of ballistic missiles. And the Sputnik launch was used as kind of the scare tactic to build that infrastructure and that argument. There was even a column written by Joseph Alsop, who was a Cold War journalist, claiming that in a few years' time, the Soviet Union would have 1,000 ICBMs to about 100 by the United States. Now, it's not clear he had any source for this, but it was widely broadcast, including John F. Kennedy using those statistics in a speech on the floor of the Senate. And in fact, the Democratic senators like Stuart Symington and Kennedy and LBJ were attacking Eisenhower from the right on the issue of a nuclear buildup. And he eventually was pushed in that direction, although not nearly as far as the military-industrial complex would have liked him to be. And of course, the end of the story was Kennedy comes into power. We find out there is no missile gap except for the one in which the United States is far ahead of the Soviet Union. So that whole manipulation of intelligence and the push by industry and ideologues and the opposing party to go to war has been replicated many times since, perhaps most clearly in the run-up to the Bush administration's invasion of Iraq in 2003. So we've got the role of the military-industrial complex in that early phase, and nuclear weapons as the key part of it. Then I'm going to fast forward to the end of the Cold War, because here seemed to be an opportunity to dismantle that complex. There was no Soviet adversary. Colin Powell gave an interview in which he said, "I'm running out of enemies," which you would think would be a good thing, but for the military-industrial complex was a threat. And so they evolved a doctrine where they took regional threats, as defined by the complex, like Iraq, like North Korea, and used them as the building blocks to keep a large military. And of course, within this, we had the genesis of the Iraq War Party, the Project for the New American Century, which was a network that included people like Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, all the main architects of the Iraq War. And the executive director of that organization was Bruce Jackson, who was a vice president for the Lockheed Martin Corporation. So a disinterested party, you might say. And so the PNAC and the ideologues around them, once 9/11 came, decided that atmosphere of fear that followed that was their moment to move on their agenda, which they did. And so we're living with the consequences of that. The tens and hundreds of thousands of people who were casualties in the Iraq War, the trillions of dollars of our resources that were spent on that in a country that now everybody's telling us we're broke. If we had that money, even the hardest of deficit hawks couldn't point to a deficit because we wouldn't have one. So that was sort of an example of the military-industrial complex overcoming a threat, the threat of peace. And I would just like to talk a little bit about their tools of influence that they use and, you know, currently to sustain their position. And, of course, first on any list is campaign contributions. And the arms industry gave about $50 million to candidates for Congress and the presidency in the last three election cycles. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, but it's only about one-fourth of what Wall Street gives. It's a tiny fraction of the $1 billion the Koch brothers are hoping to spend on the next election. And the reason for that is that campaign spending is just one tiny element of all the levers of influence that the industry has. So it doesn't lean on campaign spending as much as some other industries would do. But when they do give money, they target it very carefully. So for example, Buck McKeon, who until recently was the head of the House Armed Services Committee, who I call the one-man military-industrial complex, got $750,000 over a three-cycle period from the arms industry. All its biggest contributors were Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Northrop Grumman. They were developing stealth technology in his district, as well as the largest drone producer in the world, General Atomics. So keeping Buck happy went a long way towards promoting their agenda. And when he announced he was going to retire, Mac Thornberry from Texas, who's going to take over, has taken over at head of armed services, immediately got a flood of additional donations from these same companies. So they know who to give the money to. And then in addition to that, we have lobbying expenditures, which are an unbelievable flood of money. The industry spent $680 million over that three-cycle period I talked about. And perhaps more important, they average anywhere from 800 to 1,000 lobbyists. So that means almost two lobbyists for every member of Congress. And in fact, some staffers I've talked to whose bosses aren't even that directly involved in defense say that they can spend 20% or more of their time just talking to or fending off lobbyists from the weapons industry. Then you've got the revolving door, which is when people of influence in government go to work for industry, and then they influence their former colleagues on behalf of industry. Or people from industry go into government and make decisions that help their old employers. William Proxmire, who is probably one of the most notable gadflies in the history of the U.S. Senate, talked about the revolving door in 1969. So it's been around for quite a while. And his definition, I think, is hard to really beat. He said in a speech in 1969, "The easy movement of high-ranking military officers into jobs with major defense contractors and the reverse movements of top executives and major defense contractors into high Pentagon jobs is solid evidence of the military-industrial complex in action. It is a real threat to the public interest because it increases the chances of abuse. How hard a bargain will officers involved in procurement planning or specifications drive when they are 1 or 2 years of retirement away from working in the industry, along with 2,000 of their fellow officers who've already gone there?" And we've had many examples of this, procurement officers giving a cushy deal to companies that they know they're going to go to work for. The only example where anybody actually paid a price was a tanker program that John McCain got his teeth into, and an executive from Boeing and the contractor, the executive in the Pentagon who helped them out, actually did jail time. Now, it was probably at Club Fed, but it was still jail time. And it was an indication of something that happens all the time being punished in some small way. Now, the other tool that's used is the funding of think tanks. I think of this as political money laundering. Instead of the head of Lockheed Martin going on TV and saying, "You need our weapons," you have a seeming expert from someplace like the Center for Security Policy or the Lexington Institute or Heritage or the American Enterprise Institute pushing weapon systems and beating the drums for war, funded by the industry. So they're sort of front groups in a sense. And my three favorites, of which there are many to choose from, are the Center for Security Policy, which was started by a guy named Frank Gaffney. He left the Reagan administration because he was too conservative for them. And he immediately took hordes of contractor money to support Star Wars. And that was his major issue for many, many years. And he would give awards to people like Donald Rumsfeld called the Keeper of the Flame Award. I think he meant the Flame of Freedom, but I think it's more about us burning up as a result of his activities. So there's also a place called the National Institute for Public Policy, which really wrote the template of George W. Bush's nuclear posture. And they had a Boeing executive on their advisory board, and they were run by a guy named Keith Payne, whose main claim to fame, I think, is an article he wrote in 1980 about nuclear weapons and nuclear war, which said, "Victory is possible, and we should plan accordingly," so that, you know, maybe we would lose 10, 20, 30, 50 million people, but we could still win. So this is the kind of person who was influencing Bush, funded by the contractors. Then there's the Lexington Institute, and they have a guy named Lauren Thompson, who's the expert of choice for the press to get ideas about new weapon systems, strategy, and so forth. His think tank is funded by Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman. He does consulting for them. For many years, this was not known to people. He was never identified as such in the press. Some of us questioned that, and now they do at least mention that he's an industry consultant, and he himself mentions it in his columns for Forbes magazine. But nonetheless, he's a spokesperson, essentially, for the weapons industry, but ensconced in a think tank that's supposed to give him this aura of objectivity. And as was mentioned by Bruce, the argument of last resort is jobs, jobs, jobs. But you can create more jobs doing literally anything else. Even a tax cut creates 25% more jobs than putting money into weapon systems. So, but this argument has worked very well for them when they can't make the argument that we need these weapons to defend us. And I took a look at just one example, the F-35 combat aircraft. And Lockheed Martin said, We've got 125,000 jobs in 46 states. So good luck trying to stop us. But in fact, I looked at their numbers. There were fewer than half as many jobs as they claimed. And most of them were concentrated in Texas and California. They weren't sprinkled all over the country like they argued. So in fact, that jobs argument, part of it is smoke and mirrors. There's no question that it's there. It has an impact in very important places. But they don't blanket the country. There's a lot of places that are paying in and not getting any money back from the military buildup. And the nuclear complex itself, of course, is spread widely. There are elements of the warhead complex in California, New Mexico, Nevada, Texas, Missouri, Tennessee, and South Carolina. And that's just for the warhead complex. To build the delivery vehicles like subs and bombers, there's Connecticut, Southern California. To put the missiles in the ground, there's North Dakota, there's Wyoming, there's Montana. And then there's bases in Georgia and Washington State for the subs. So they have Netflix spread it around. And certainly they can motivate the congresspeople from those districts on their behalf. But I do believe, despite that, that the military-industrial complex is not all-powerful and that we can dismantle it if we work hard enough at it and mobilize enough people to do so. There's one more example of corporate influence I wanted to talk about, and it's something I call party favors. There's a very fine symphony orchestra in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which is little known. But the reason there is such a good orchestra there is because it's in the district of the late Representative Jack Murtha, who was one of the masters of pork barrel politics in Congress. In fact, the headline of his obituary called him that. So that was how important it was in his life in Congress. So anyway, the Johnstown Orchestra was his wife's favorite charity. The companies poured the money in as another way to curry favor with him. So it's sort of like any little angle they can find, they will use it. The University of Mississippi has something called the Trent Lott Leadership Institute, which sounds sort of like a contradiction in terms, but nonetheless it exists. And Lockheed Martin gave $1 million to help get that thing running when Trent Lott was the majority leader of the Senate. More recently, Buck McKeon's wife, Patricia, decided to run for the state legislator in the state of California, which costs a lot of money. And her big issue was she wanted them to stop charging for plastic bags at the supermarket. So lo and behold, Lockheed Martin and Boeing and others decided, we too are against paying for plastic bags at the supermarket. And that's why we're going to fund Buck McKeon's wife to run for the California state legislature. And they said this with a straight face when people asked them about the contributions, but of course it doesn't pass the laugh test. But it was yet another way to sort of circumvent what limited, you know, curbs there are left on political money to curry favor with a powerful legislature who's got his hands on the money spigot for the military-industrial complex. Now, this is the controversial part of my remarks in the sense that, I don't know how many people believe this, but I certainly believe it myself, which is that the military-industrial complex is not 10 feet tall, we can't beat it politically, and we shouldn't let this notion that they're all-powerful demobilize people when we're trying to get, when we're pursuing life-saving objectives like getting rid of nuclear weapons. So these are small examples, but I think they're indicative of what's possible. When Lockheed Martin wanted to keep Obama from canceling the F-22, he signed up 200 members of the House, 44 senators, many governors, the unions involved, to write to Obama and press him to keep building this thing. But because of pressure from non-governmental groups and the fact that Obama actually stood up and threatened to veto something, they were able to stop that. And the industry just assumed they were going to win. In fact, everybody assumed that. The press assumed it. Many of my colleagues assumed it. And it's a small thing in that ocean of money that they get. But I think it's indicative of that they can be beat. The second example is the caps on Pentagon spending, which have been in place since the Budget Control Act. Now, we can talk about how the industry's been getting around that by stuffing money in the war budget that's not related to the wars. But nonetheless, they're going to get $1 trillion less over the next decade than they wanted. So they're not getting their wish list. And this was driving them insane. So they had a huge campaign that said our economy was going to collapse if we made these modest cuts in Pentagon spending. they said we'd lose 1 million jobs. Well, in fact, many of the cuts were made, employment increased. That 1 million job loss never happened. And it's actually gotten to the point where even some members of Congress are a little skeptical that, you know, lo and behold, maybe these people have been lying to us all these years. So I think, finally, because these things are so expensive and because our country has so many other needs, I think that's another source of support. And I see it in, there's actually kind of a right-left convergence here. On the left, we know that our country needs many, many things, more than we need to spend $1 trillion on nuclear delivery vehicles over the next couple decades. On the right, there's a little sort of caucus that says, well, actually, the Pentagon is part of government. And so if you want smaller government, you have to reduce the Pentagon. Now, I view those as kind of allies of convenience. Obviously, there's many other things on their agenda that I couldn't possibly sign up to. But it's an interesting period in Washington. And I think as people get mobilized around these issues and related issues like campaign finance reform and climate change, I think we'll find that the Washington power system is somewhat in disarray. And that may give us some opportunities that we didn't have in the past to push our agenda. Thank you.